At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
I first started running about 15 years ago as a way to quit smoking. Back then, my running clothes were very Rocky Balboa. So sweatpants, sweatshirt. Anyone who goes hiking or trail running knows that it's a lot easier and a lot more fun when you're wearing the right gear. Jonji makes performance apparel that'll take you farther on your runs and hikes. They have this merino wool hoodie that I wore on multiple trail runs this weekend. It's soft, it's warm, and most importantly, it does not get stinky when you get stinky. Another reason to love Jonji is that they donate 2% of all sales towards clean water projects, raising nearly $1 million so far. Head to jonji.com to find your new favorite trail wear, outdoors accessories, and essentials. And use the code OUTSIDE for 10% off at jonji.com. That's JANJI.com with the code OUTSIDE for 10% off. When I was a little kid, my whole family, grandparents included, packed into a Dodge Caravan and went on a 2-week road trip to Wyoming. We saw the rodeo in Cody, a grizzly bear in Yellowstone National Park, and an epic thunderstorm near Devil's Tower. On that trip, I fell in love with the West and the natural world. This might sound cheesy, but it kind of made me who I am today. Wyoming has it all. Breathtaking hikes, kid-friendly museums, two of the coolest national parks in the country. The truth lies west. Discover yours at travelwyoming.com.
I'm Jessica Rivera, and I am from San Juan, Puerto Rico. And I was raised in the barrio. It's called Barrio Sabana Llana. And I was raised by my grandmother, who was a community organizer. And it was normal to me to, like, there's something going on in the community, so we have to organize and help.
My name is Eddie Guerra, and I was born and raised in a small town in the west of Puerto Rico. It's called San Sebastian. So I grew up, about a little bit about my family. I grew up in a Pentecostal, very religious family, very conservative family. My father was a chaplain also, and I've always been very involved in my church, and it was very important to me.
Hey, Outside In listeners, meet Jezebel and Eddie. Like many great love stories, theirs starts somewhere romantic.
It was October 23rd of 2008 when I gave a workshop, and I was by then I was the president of a student organization for the American Concrete Institute. All right, and it was part of my civil engineering program. And that night I met her, but it was more of a hello, how are you, and that's it. But very professional, right? Very boring.
I was like, I'm a president. This topic is interesting for my students. So like, I was on mission. So I think we talked, and
it was all business.
It was
right,
all
Jessica?
Business.
Yeah.
Yes.
No. Nothing else. Very boring. We didn't see each other again until my last day, my very last day. I finished classes, I finished finals, and then I saw her in the streets
yeah,
where everybody gathers in the town of Mayagüez when they're done with finals. I saw her dancing salsa in the streets.
But my side of the story is that between that workshop and the time that we saw each other in the streets, I had already checked you on Facebook and like I did my FBI work. Like, who is this guy?
The first time I danced salsa was when I met Jezebel. It was forbidden to dance salsa in my home. I grew
up. And then my name is Jezebel.
Yeah.
Remember, Eddie grew up a preacher's son in a Pentecostal church.
Well, Jezebel was a wicked queen from the Old Testament, you see. That was December 16th, 2008. Since that day, we have been talking every day.
Every single day, yeah.
Like I said, this is a love story. But in this love story, it's not just boy meets girl, the two fall in love. It's boy meets girl, and the two fall in love with one of the most controversial proposed solutions to climate change, nuclear energy.
We learned that it was not too much about the technology, but about trust.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Today on the show, Inside, a grassroots effort to convince Puerto Rico to build a nuclear power plant. A nuclear power plant on an island that's right in the middle of the Atlantic hurricane track. Is that a good idea? It's a question that gets to the heart of one of the most heated debates in environmentalism today. What will our transition to a low-carbon future actually look like? Eddie and Jezebel's story gets all tangled up in nuclear power after college. Eddie majored in civil engineering, where he learned all about protecting big structures from earthquakes.
And I graduated 2009, 2010 timeframe, where just recently the market had crashed, and there were no new buildings being built in Puerto Rico, so in the U.S. So it was the worst time for a structural designer to graduate with that degree. And I said, oh my goodness, I've had about 8 interviews, and what the hell is going on?
As he left grad school, Jezebel had just finished undergrad and had been accepted to the University of Pittsburgh for her master's. Eddie moved there to join her.
The next weekend, we went to this Latin American picnic, and you met somebody there that said, actually, we're looking for an engineer with your background.
Correct, yeah. And he approached me and I met him. And to my surprise, there was one industry that was hiring. And that was the nuclear industry. That was October 5th is when I finally started. But then in 2011, the Fukushima Daiichi accident happened. And it was the earthquake, the 9-point magnitude earthquake, that triggered the tsunami, of more than 40 feet tall tsunami that really wiped out and flooded the emergency diesel generators of the Fukushima Daiichi plant. So that was a very, very scary moment, and the whole world paralyzed in that day. Then the U.S., the U.S. Congress mandated all U.S. nuclear licensees to perform seismic evaluations of all the reactors here in the U.S.
What are the odds of that? Eddie graduated with a degree that he thought he would use to protect bridges and skyscrapers from earthquakes in L.A. or something, but instead he lands in the nuclear industry by chance just 5 months before an earthquake. Exactly the type of risk he studied causes the worst nuclear accident in a generation.
Absolutely.
And it took you around the world. You went to South Africa.
Yeah. Then the rest is history. And I was so lucky that I was one of the first engineers to do these evaluations after Fukushima. And I saw by the numbers how safe, resilient, and rugged our existing plants are against earthquakes.
And what are the odds of this, too? That a disaster, a massive safety failure, would lead Eddie to eventually believe that nuclear is much, much safer than he ever knew.
Now I'm moving on into this new reactor technology that is way safer, with additional safety barriers.
This is how Eddie and Jezebel would come to find themselves in the midst of what has become one of the biggest wedges that divides the many groups of people who all call themselves environmentalists. Way back before James Hansen, who famously brought climate change to the center of our political discourse, way before climate change was a glimmer in his computer models, opposition to nuclear power was a central tenet of American environmentalism. Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, Friends of the Earth, the Union of Concerned Scientists, all of these groups have either been actively opposed to nuclear power or at least skeptical of society's need for it. But as we've drifted further and further downstream towards the falls of some of the more dramatic impacts of climate change, advocates for the technology have begun to multiply. And some old nuclear opponents, like James Hansen himself, have even flipped and become advocates. The question the movement writ large is actively wrestling with is, can or should we try to design a zero-carbon future that ignores nuclear power? Or does it have to be part of the solution? Okay, now before we get back to Jezebel and Eddie, let's just do a bit of Nuclear 101. The new reactors Eddie learned about while traveling all over the world are collectively referred to as advanced nuclear power. The nuclear reactors you've probably heard of, probably the ones that have had catastrophic or near-catastrophic accidents, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, Fukushima, are all light water reactors.
Light water just means regular water. So water cooled.
This is Jessica Lovering. She researches and works on nuclear energy. She's wrapping up her PhD at Carnegie Mellon University. Nuclear fission generates a lot of heat. That's what makes it dangerous. The term nuclear meltdown literally means that the uranium is allowed to get so hot that it melts and burns through steel and concrete and anything else in its way. To keep it under control, light water reactors just pump a ton of water. If you can't keep the pumps going, the water boils off and the core gets really hot.
Water boils at pretty low temperatures, relatively, and so it's always an issue when you're trying to cool a reactor of how do you keep the water from boiling, how do you contain the high pressure of the steam, and how do you keep pumping in that water.
Advanced nuclear designs, the ones that got Eddie excited, they ditch water altogether.
For a lot of these designs, they just can't have those meltdowns that we've experienced with Three Mile Island and Chernobyl and Fukushima.
There are a whole slew of these water-free designs, but just one example is called a molten salt reactor. Instead of water, it cools with liquid salt, which cannot get hot enough to boil off.
The reactor can sort of cool itself through natural processes, vertoconvective cooling, like a soup in a pot.
The elegance of these new designs is what Eddie fell in love with. This is what led him to start assembling his dream team, nuclear engineers who were all part of the Puerto Rican diaspora.
I immediately reached out to a couple of friends of mine from Puerto Rico and that also worked in the U.S. nuclear industry. And I told them, guys, these small reactors are something so different. Why not presenting this option to the current energy crisis going on in Puerto Rico?
Generating electricity on islands is a constant struggle. Fuel has to come in on a boat. Connecting to nearby neighbors to import or export power is expensive or impossible, and that drives up costs. Puerto Rico has some of the highest electricity rates in the United States. It means that things that might not make economic sense on the mainland can pencil out on islands. They can be laboratories for solutions that are almost cheap enough for the mainstream, but not quite.
This was 2015, Sam. I reach out to good friends of mine, people who work as operators for Exelon, which is one of the biggest nuclear operators in the nation, people who work for Bechtel, for example, who is one of the biggest designers of nuclear power plant. So we got together and we said, no one had to convince us that from a technical point of view, this makes sense. We were convinced because we were in the trenches. We did the work. No one had to convince us about this.
And this is the part that I always like to talk about, because Eddie's having this is happening in our dinner table, okay?
Yeah.
So on one side, Eddie's having all these conversations with his, you know, his colleagues and, you know, all these papers. And then on the other side of the table, I am planning events and doing, you know, community engagement projects.
This might be a good place to note that a lot of people are really freaked out by nuclear power. And the first skeptic that Eddie had to convince was Jezebel. Remember, she had worked in community organizing. She went on to get her degree in public health.
Eddie's somebody that, you know, whatever he's into, it's a good thing, so you should follow, right? But then this time was difficult, because we were talking about, like, nuclear in Puerto Rico. I'm like, what would happen if, you know, there's an earthquake? And what would happen if, you know, it would explode? And where would people go? And, you know, why do we need nuclear? We have solar and wind and all the renewables that we can do. So I went and started finding, you know, information on my own. And I couldn't find a reason not to like nuclear. That's when I started telling, you know, Eddie, like, okay, we need to talk about this differently.
If Eddie brought the enthusiasm for the technology, Jezebel brought the savvy to know that the technology has baggage.
Like, everybody have watched The Simpsons, and I think it was, like, my favorite one. So that's, I mean, number one, that's, like, how it works for me, right? Like, I'm thinking that it shines, you know, green, and it's, like, all liquid, and, like, you have an operator that doesn't care. You know, like, all these different things. Like, that's what I had in my mind. And, but then, of course, I also think about Chernobyl. Of course, I also think about Fukushima, and then that's it, right? But then, remember that I come in from the public health standpoint, and that I'm doing a lot of social justice kind of work. So, in social justice kind of work, we are kind of against anything that is an elite, right? So the rich, you know, white people are the ones that, you know, never want to really do something for the community, right? So nuclear, that's the image that I had to.
Yeah.
And that was also something that I said, no, like, it doesn't fit in Puerto Rico. And we have been very particular on who and how we bring people into this project, because it has to be somebody that really cares about, you know, the community and really wants to make a difference.
The organization they create together, the Nuclear Alternative Project, is designed to be the opposite of what has driven the creation of nuclear power plants previously. Instead of top-down, it would be bottom-up. The organization is all volunteer. Instead of prescriptive, it would be collaborative. They want a conversation and study on the nuclear question, a discussion of whether and how and where the technology could fit on the island. And instead of being driven by colonial urges, it would be local. All of the members were born on Puerto Rico, but had to move away.
Hello, my name is Jesus M. Nunez. I was born and raised in Puerto Rico.
Hi, my name is Olga Marie Toledo. Born and raised in the beautiful island of Puerto Rico.
I am Luis Rodriguez. I am a person that was born in Puerto Rico.
Ever since I left Puerto Rico in 2011, I was longing for an opportunity to give back to Puerto Rico with my professional background.
Since I learned about their effort, I have contacted many of my friends and other residents in Puerto Rico.
We Boricuas are very resistive to change, especially when it comes from outsiders. I believe that the discussion is different because we are born and raised in Puerto Rico, and we also put our passion and commitment to this project because we want the best for our family members that are still living in there.
So I really look forward for many more Boricuas to learn about all that nuclear power has to offer and to, like me, realize it is possible and it would be of great benefit to the island.
Before we go any farther, we need just a splash more context. On top of having the expensive electricity challenge that all islands have, Puerto Rico has its own challenges, unique to its history. And to give us kind of the pocket postcard version of how Puerto Rico's grid got the way it is today, we're going to turn to Javier Rua. He's a lawyer from the island who's worked for various government regulators and is now working for a renewable energy company.
Puerto Rico's electric company has been, you know, or had been a self-regulated monopoly for all of its life.
Puerto Rico has just one electric company, PREPA. It's owned and operated by the Puerto Rican government. And until 2014, it was self-regulated. Back before the infamous Arab oil embargoes of the 1970s, Puerto Rico had a bunch of oil refineries in the south of the island.
But those things just became dinosaurs after the oil embargo, and all that demand was lost.
But a bunch of power plants had already been built down in the south to power the refineries. But meanwhile, most of the people live in the north.
And you have to transmit that power over mountains, 60, 70 miles of cables.
That's the first ingredient, the long fuse in a coming disaster, a heavy reliance on long-distance poles and wires. The second ingredient was political and economic.
Puerto Rico's economic development has been, you know, based for most of its history on tax breaks, Section 936, which was a federal tax break. And when those tax breaks were started to be seen by Congress as kind of like corporate welfare, they started to be phased out.
This was under Bill Clinton in the late 90s.
And as they were phased out, at least a third of our industrial base left.
We're talking about factories closing en masse and moving elsewhere. All of PREPA's customers disappearing. When this happens in the electricity business, there are two options. Raise rates, which is super unpopular, or don't spend money on trimming trees, replacing and fixing old leaning utility poles, shoring up old infrastructure.
And then you had this system that was and is cash strapped, that couldn't really do significant infrastructure maintenance, and it starts becoming really old.
So Puerto Rico had an old-fashioned system that required a lot of upkeep, but a single utility that could no longer afford to maintain it. There are a lot of ways that you could quantify this, but here's one number that blew me away. When you transmit electricity from one place to another, some of it gets lost along the way. On the continental U.S., we waste about 5% of the electricity we generate. In Puerto Rico, it's more like 17%. So that's ingredient number two, old infrastructure.
And then you're hit by a storm.
What did Hurricane Maria do to Jezebel and Eddie's campaign to bring nuclear to the island? That's after a break.
At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
I live by routines, especially my same-day delivery routine with Shipt. Because when Sunday rolls around, I'm not scared. I got my shopper on the way with all my favorites. Shipt. Delight in every delivery. Learn more at Shipt.com.
Save big money on everything for your spring projects at Menards. We have all of your garden and landscaping essentials. Master Garden Premium Garden Soil contains a slow-release fertilizer that feeds gardens for up to 9 months. It produces better results and is ready to use for all your gardening needs. Save big on Menards' great selection of garden and landscaping products. Compare brands in-store or online at Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Hurricane Maria happened in September 2017. October 2017, I went to Puerto Rico and I took supplies and food to my father and my mother and my family in my hometown of San Sebastian. It was for the first time my dad called me to tell me, Eddie, if you have some water, just let us know because it's difficult to find water here. And that scared me. And I said, wow, this time is different.
This part of the story you know. Thousands died. It took almost a full year to restore power to the last home. But at the same time, something else was happening.
The solar industry really saved people in Puerto Rico. Let's put it out there. You cannot take that away. And it really solved an issue that was, you know, that was immediate. Like there was an emergency, and this technology really responded the way that it needed.
The number of rooftop solar installations on the island doubled in the 12 months after Hurricane Maria. And politically, it was a huge moment for renewable energy advocates.
Maria, what it did was like, it just, everybody was on fire. Everybody was like, you know, traumatized of everything that's happening. So these groups were already pushing for renewables. And these groups were already looking for this independence. So Maria happens, and then all these groups came together and started pushing, let's move to 100% renewable because that's the solution.
This past spring, Puerto Rico passed a law calling for the island to be powered by 100% renewable energy by 2050. That explicitly means not nuclear energy. Nuclear doesn't emit carbon, but it still uses a fuel, uranium, that we have to dig up from underground. It's not part of this definition. You might think that this would have been the death knell for Jezebel and Eddie's project, but they haven't given up.
But what Maria did in Puerto Rico is that it made people look at each other and say, we can do this on our own. We don't need the government. We can do this on our own. And
that's
it just
true.
Like it really created and brought all this power that was asleep in the people. So it created this beautiful thing. And that's why, you know, I am not against renewable whatsoever. What I am against is that the renewable industry really saw an opportunity here to push the entire agenda. But interestingly, we have pharmaceuticals and manufacturing and energy intensive industries that need a different kind of energy as well.
Puerto Rico gets a lot of sun, and it's not hard to get a solar and battery array that can provide most or all of your day-to-day power. But what if you've got a pharmaceutical facility that has three shifts working to keep that factory going around the clock? What if you've got a factory that needs megawatts of power 24/7? Jezebel and Eddie are saying, renewables are fine, but we want more.
We know that Puerto Rico is not a third world country. We know the huge potential in Puerto Rico to be kind of, you know, the Singapore of the Caribbean. That's how we see it. So when we see from an engineering and technical point of view that a vision, a strong and modern economy like that is proposed to be sustained by renewables, from an engineering and technical point of view, we see huge inconsistencies.
PREPA, the one electric company on Puerto Rico, just released their plan for the next 20 years. It involves shutting down power plants that burn coal and oil and replacing them with solar power and natural gas. It calls for two new terminals to import liquefied natural gas and replace a whole fleet of almost two dozen small natural gas-fired power plants scattered all over the island. Rather than taking aim at the renewable energy part of that equation, Jezebel and Eddie are taking aim at the natural gas part of the plan. Now you might think, okay, we've spent this whole episode talking about this grand vision of nuclear energy powering the Singapore of the Caribbean, but you've only just barely mentioned the fact that many people are terrified of this technology and want to be nowhere near it. And while that's true, there's actually a reason that nuclear might not have a future on Puerto Rico, or anywhere for that matter, that really kind of trumps the whole fear thing. When we think about why it's necessary to come up with these new designs, I guess the question is like, what is the question they're trying to answer? Is it really safety or?
No. Yeah, I think the big challenge of nuclear and the big obstacle is actually cost. It's not safety.
That's Jessica Lovering of Carnegie Mellon University again.
And the two are related in some ways. It can be very expensive to guarantee safety if you're doing it in inefficient ways through lots of backup systems and redundant safety systems that you have to engineer to really precise levels.
Relative to other sources, there's not much nuclear power being built in the Western world right now. And among the plants that are being built, there have been some spectacular cost overruns. A huge plant in Georgia was first proposed at $14 billion, but at last check was expected to cost $25 billion. Another underway in Great Britain was expected to cost £16 billion, but has since ballooned to £22 billion. A third in France was pitched at €3.3 billion and was planned to open in 2012. But as of last month, the new cost estimate is over €12 billion, four times as much, and it's still not finished. In other words, before we even get to the point where plants get proposed and people get freaked out by them, they need to be cheap enough that someone's got to be willing to pay for them. And for these next-generation advanced reactors to take off, the biggest hurdle they have to overcome is this history the industry has of totally blowing their budgets.
And if they're not competitive, then they won't happen. And so I think they're with more in the anti-nuclear crowds. You see this concern of like, oh, we don't want the government funding another nuclear boondoggle. And, you know, they're right.
Jessica says, historically, there have been a few countries in a few times in history that have managed to build cost-effective nuclear power industries. France in the 70s, South Korea right now. And the lesson from those countries is that you have to go big. Building a lot of plants allows the industry to figure out how to make them efficiently. And she thinks that's one of the reasons that building smaller plants, like the kind Eddie and Jezebel are promoting, might actually help drive costs down.
While the U.S. has a long history with nuclear, France has a long history with nuclear, they really haven't been building that much in the past. So, you know, these plants that are under construction at Georgia are sort of the first ones in 30 years. And so you're sort of starting all over again. So you lost a lot of that knowledge and expertise and sort of capabilities to build these plants. So if the reactors get smaller, the market can stay the same size, but it means you're getting more multiples of that factory fabrication. So you're getting more learning by doing. It's not just about getting one project built. It's about setting up the regulation and the market incentives so that you're going to build many of these over time. And when they're really small, it helps you get those many lined up to go.
So that's the bullish case on why advanced nuclear might work out, assuming it actually can drive down costs. But even if it can do so, people in Puerto Rico still might not go for it. Why?
No, okay, so here's my recent backup history, which is the times that my grid has gone down.
This is Javier Rua again, the former regulator. The renewable energy company that he works for now is called Sunrun. It sells solar panels and backup battery systems. He pulled up his smartphone app to read to me all of the outages that his home had had recently.
November 11th, 6 minutes. November 6th, 5 minutes. November 4th, 5 minutes. November 3rd, 13 minutes. November 3rd, 1 minute. November 3rd, again, 4 minutes. November 2nd, 5 minutes. October 31st, 7 minutes. And it keeps on going. And then it's kind of like every day or every 2 days.
Yeah.
October 11th, there was a two-hour outage. October 8th, there was a two-and-a-half-hour outage. And it keeps on going until since I installed my system.
The lights are on again in Puerto Rico, but the island's grid is still very fragile. And so-called blue sky outages happen almost every week. Puerto Ricans spend about five times more hours without electricity than your average mainland customer. So Puerto Ricans are already voting with their feet, installing solar panels and batteries at a pretty impressive clip. And this, again, means there are fewer customers paying for PREPA's old, gasping poles and wires, those same poles and wires that are already failing every other day and dropping people's power.
Everybody suffered after Maria, you know, all social classes. We all learned what it means to not have power for months. And because we understand, we've suffered, right? We know what power is. We know not only the cost of power, but the value of it, you know. Solar and storage is just a proposal that really has met, you know, its price points that, and now are getting better and better and better and better.
It might be that PREPA is just not poised to be on the cutting edge of anything right now. As it stands, they're facing a decades-long slog to work their way back out of crippling debt. It's a lot. But Jezebel and Eddie are a long way from giving up.
And
this fall, kinda against all odds, they achieved a major milestone in injecting nuclear back into the conversation.
Muy buenos días, todo el mundo, todos y todas. Good morning, everybody. My name is Jezebel Rivera, and I am the executive director and community.
The Nuclear Alternative Project, Jezebel and Eddie's all-volunteer collection of diaspora nuclear engineers, won a grant from the United States Department of Energy. More than $800,000 to do a feasibility study of advanced nuclear power on the island. This was the press conference they called in San Juan.
We are not going to build a nuclear plant. We are not going to push the envelope for nuclear. We are going to find information if nuclear is feasible to be part of this discussion on how do we get to our goals.
Who knows if they stand a chance of convincing Puerto Rico to give advanced nuclear a chance? As it stands, they're not getting much help from the mass media. The freelancer we hired to go to this press conference was the only reporter in the audience. Then again, maybe we're not the audience that matters.
We want to make sure that we're going to the plazas and we are having models in the plazas and we're with the people and they can see it, they can touch it, they can break it down.
The technology is not the roadblock in Puerto Rico, but we need to engage the public. We need to use the results of this feasibility study, as Jezebel said, to engage the people from the beginning. Let them feel that they are the main stakeholder in this process. From there, Sam, you know, many things can happen.
Outside In was produced this week by me, Sam Evans-Brown, with help from Jimmy Gutierrez, Justine Paradise, Sarah Ernst, and especially Taylor Quimby. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is director of Blue Sky Outage Ice Cream Scavenging. Please do remember, Outside In is a public radio show, and public radio does rely on donations if you want it to happen. We have lots of great thank you gifts to those who do support the show. You can find them at outsideinradio.org. Also, find us on the social medias. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Outside In Radio. Music in this episode came from Blue Dot Sessions. Our theme music was made by Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
I live by routines, especially my same-day delivery routine with Shipt. Because when Sunday rolls around, I'm not scared. I got my shopper on the way with all my favorites. Shipt, delight in every delivery. Learn more at Shipt.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.